Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Simon Barrett, and I'd like to welcome you to Blogger News on the Radio. This is another in our ongoing series, The Food Revolution Papers, a chance to look at the politics on what's on your dinner plate. Who ever thought that food would be a political item? But it is. It's a very political item. Joining me are my two great friends, the writing and research team of Manny Barling and Ashley F. Brooks. Good morning both of you.
Well, good morning, Simon. We lost Ashley for a moment. Like all good wives, she disappeared for a minute, but she'll be with us in a moment.
That's splendid. It's probably good that she's not here.
I don't know why I got cut off. I'm sorry. But I'm here.
I know that this is an incredibly serious program, but about 10 minutes ago, I was perusing this huge pile of press releases that I seem to get every morning, and I found this delightful one. I haven't even read it all yet, but there is a company called PantyByPost.com, and they're extolling the fact, the virtue, that they're about to enter the Russian market. The deal is, you send this company some money, and once a month they mail you a pair of really, really cute French panties.
Well, is this site for politicians only?
I'm guessing. Just do 5 or 1. It says things like, well, they've got some pictures, our beautiful packaging, the perfect gift for any occasion.
Oh, you can take them to dinner parties.
That's right. Okay, enough of that. But I just had to share it with you. It was too good not to.
Well, before we jump into the show, Ashton had a story we wanted to share because not always do you get an uplifting story. I don't know if anyone saw the movie Message in a Bottle with Kevin Costner that came out about 10 years ago. It didn't come out. It escaped. It should have never been released. It is one of the worst films I've ever seen, but it has this wonderful beginning where, Kevin Costner sends out this message in a bottle, and it's a poem of true love. And when you see this character, I don't think he could write his name. And it's found, I think it was by Robin Wright Penn, Sean Penn's ex-wife. And suddenly this five-minute wonderful story ends with her finding the bottle and wanting to meet him. And from then on, it was downhill. So Ash and I picked up this story about this 10-year-old boy who tossed a message in the bottle in the Pacific Ocean about a year ago. So it's right off the coast of Oregon. So a 9-year-old girl about 2 weeks ago in Hawaii found it. I hope it didn't have a dirty message. I don't know what the message was. So anyway, she couldn't believe that she'd found this bottle when she opened it. Here was this note, and the boy thought it was broken when he threw it in the water. It hit his grandfather's boat, and he thought it actually had broken. And so now we're not sure whether they're going to run off and get married, or it had an offer of something, unlawful. Maybe he was trying to sell her something. We're not sure what's in it. So anyway, there was a award of $150. I'm wondering now whether this kid is going to go for it and give her the $150 and visit her in Hawaii. So we're not sure whether this is a dating issue or a potluck issue, but it seems so funny that a 9-year-old kid would have a 10-year-old boy would have the idea of throwing this in the ocean, hoping that someone would pick it up, and it actually made it all the way to Hawaii.
Wow.
I wouldn't you love to know there in the future what happens to these two?
Oh, indeed. That's just a wonderful story.
I love that. I think it's great.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, you know, there was a story about a guy in Florida that had done that, that supposedly that was missing for 50 years and it came up late, but no one's quite sure whether that's a true story or not. But anyway, we've got a whole bunch of interesting things today, and one of the ones that bothers me the most is, you know, we've been doing this ongoing bit about how the government's so involved with Monsanto, DuPont, and other biotech companies to put out genetically modified foods. Well, I was checking around, and I read some speeches by Mike Dwyer, who's the global policy analyst for the Department of Agriculture, and his job basically is to run around and make speeches around the world and try and convince people to buy our goods and whatever, and promote foreign goods. Well, it turns out that his speeches were also basically devoted to GMOs. And so the other day in Australia, he has this whole long speech where about GMOs are needed to dramatically increase yields on land that are using to produce food, trying to convince everybody there that they should switch to GMO. And he talks about how genetically modified corn and soy crops prove themselves in the U.S., but wheat is trailing. And then there's a wonderful quote. I actually pulled it up and looked on a video because I couldn't believe he said that. He says, quote, "You know, right now there's no one producing a lot of GMO wheat. I think there's a lot of producers that want to try it, but no one wants to go first. Clearly it would be on my short list of products to go GM." So here we have the global analyst, the U.S. government, running around the world trying to commit everybody, commit to Monsanto's GMO corn, soy, and wheat. How are we going to deal with this product fairly, test it fairly, if our government's predetermined to want to sell it around the world no matter how bad it is? And, you know, Ashley, you've been looking at these things, all the letters, the memos. It just comes out more and more every day just how much our government's involved with Monsanto and DuPont in these areas.
I'm very disappointed. I'm disappointed to discover that they are backing the science with it when there is so little science, actually, as far as I'm concerned, because, again, if the scientists are paying their own scientists to come up with an answer, what answer do they think they're going to come up with? And the tests are just prove over and over in Europe that these are not truthful tests.
Yeah. And in fact, let's put this in a little perspective, Simon. You know, canola oil, which really stands for a word of Canada and oil put together, is really what's called rapeseed oil. Comes from rapeseed, which is essentially a genetically modified product that's made crop in Canada. So when you see all this canola oil and it's better for you, it's basically genetically modified rapeseed. So I was taking a look at a variety of different articles about pesticides and things. So I came up with this interesting series of articles that talk about people who put soybean oil and canola oil on their salads and everything else. But it turns out something that I didn't realize is that canola oil and soybean oil is the principal product in pesticides. It's the active ingredient. And basically, canola oil is a GMO food and crop that's been classified as a biopesticide by the EPA. So here you are putting this canola oil, cooking your popcorn in it, making your salads out of it, and it's a pesticide, a biopesticide. Boy, that really makes me run out and buy it. How about you, Simon? You want to go get a case?
Well, I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, potential uses in the future. If you want some popcorn and you discover that you're out of canola oil, you can always go to the garage and get your can of Roundup.
No, I think Roundup is something different.
Well, wait a minute, honey. If it's genetically modified corn, it resists Roundup. So you can boil it in Roundup because it supposedly resists it, right?
I mean, it might give it a might give it a really, really interesting flavor.
Yeah, as long as the listeners know that we are joking, do not do this.
They don't know you're joking. They're on the wrong show. But let's put this in perspective. Canola oil is found in all fast foods and most convenient foods. You pick up a label, and it's hard to find anything, especially a frozen food and other packaged foods without canola oil. And, for example, you'll find it in chocolate, chocolate candies, Hershey's, all those, breads, potato chips. How about baby food? You're feeding this to children, and children's formula contains it. Most peanut butters and cookies contain canola oil. Frozen French fries, rye breads, how about chocolate syrups? Worse yet, mayonnaise. I mean, that to me is a mortal sin, putting canola oil in mayonnaise. How about granola bars? They're supposed to be healthy. And, you know, look around, lunch meats, margarines, snacks you get in the movies, tortillas, and a lot of different bakery goods. Which reminds me, remember the scenes in Back to the Future where he gets all the garbage and food and throws it into the flux converter and powers the DeLorean? Well, now I understand the guy knew that you could take all the canola oil and biopesticides and all this food and put them in to make a biofood diesel for your car. So instead of throwing your garbage out, stick it in your garbage, your gas tank, right, Simon?
Absolutely. In fact, you know, but there are people that actually do that. You can take the oil that restaurants use in their deep fryer, clean it up a little bit, and it basically burns just like diesel.
Wow. You know, and I was thinking that you were going to go towards maybe a Sunfire for sale in Florida that has stains in the trunk. Maybe that's a biodiesel car, too. But, you know, this gets even worse when you look at it. I mean, you know, when you take a look at some of the products, there's a year-round pesticide called Vegol, V-E-G-O-L. And if you get into, meanwhile, my cat's trying to destroy our studio. If you look at that particular product, you'll find it's 96% is canola oil. So, you know,
and it's guaranteed, on it, it says guaranteed to kill pests and bugs. So you're actually having 96% of it is canola oil.
And I think it says your children and animals, too. You know, Bayer, who makes the aspirin, the German country, company, also makes a natural insect.
Natural in quotes, please. That's got to be in a quotation, right, isn't it?
Yeah, right, natural, you know, right, killing product called Natria, N-A-T-R-I-A, for home pest control that, as Bayer describes in his literature, kills on contact. The active ingredient? Soybean oil. Oh, wonderful. It's nice to know that, you know, if you're pouring soybean oil on your salad and you see an ant running by, you just flash some at it, and if you hit him, wow, he's dead on contact.
Well, it gets back to that USDA research place where I repeatedly say this because I'm still stunned by it, where the soybean oil smells like paint, tastes like paint, but they remove the linoleic acid, so I guess you can't smell or taste the fact that it's actually a pesticide.
Oh, yeah.
I just want to clarify something. You did say that soybean oil was listed as the active ingredient.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Whoa.
You know, and it's funny because they carry these product labels like caution, avoid contact with skin or clothing, or call a poison control center doctor for treatment advice. So does that mean when you have your soybean oil drenched salad that you should call a doctor or don't let it touch you? You can eat it, but don't let it touch your skin or clothing. I mean, it's just really horrible. And another one of the common labels on these products that I looked at is environmental hazards do not apply directly to water. Okay. So are you supposed to eat this?
It's in all the salad. You know what, Simon? It's in all the salad. Most of them, the ones that are your at the grocery store dressing.
About wishbone and all the.
Oh yeah,
ones,
I look on the back of them. It's got all this in a canola and the soybean oil.
Uh-huh.
But what's confusing to me right now is that I'm now picking up organic, and when I pick up organic and I see on the back of it, and this one confuses me, Manny. I'm sure it has confused the listeners that on the back they've got canola oil. How can you have organic canola oil, and is it safe? Is it the same as a pesticide?
Well, there is organic canola oil, but I'm not convinced it's any better than the others, but there's a very small amount of it. But those products you're talking about are always from major manufacturers we're finding more and more exemptions and loopholes into what they can get away with in organic food. And we're concerned that over the next year or two, they're going to be successful in diluting what's in organic food because of the sheer might of their ability to convince Congress to do what they want. And that leads me into our next story, which is another tale of governmental, you know, lack of lobbying, lack of use and manipulation. And it's a recall story. Before we get to your other recall story, honey, this is a story about a woman, Catherine Ayers, who was 36 when she decided she had too much pain in her hip. She couldn't stand it. So she had a surgically implanted metal-on-metal hip joint that made her pain-free. But a few years later, she startled to receive a letter saying the artificial joint was being recalled. You know, and as she said, I loved her quote before Congress, in my mind, recalls were for dishwashers and cars, not body parts, you know. So they ultimately reviewed this implant. It turns out that there are just scores of people like this, and it led the Institute of Medicine, an arm of the National Academy of Sciences, to call the government to redesign a new system for evaluating and approving many high-risk medical devices before they reach the market. And, you know, it's really interesting. Basically, the chairman of the committee said it's not clear that the process is serving the needs of either industry or patients. So let's talk about what this process is, because I was horrified. It basically, they want a new system to go through this because, as an inventor, a guy named Fischel pointed out, who invented the implantable insulin pump and a series of coronary stents, said the medical device approval process is inconsistent with that of the FDA staff because they're not even trained to review this. They're not even capable of doing this. So, first of all, we got an FDA that's not capable of doing it. So the National Academy of Sciences came up with this whole thing where they have 25 different things they want to add into this new system to protect the public. Well, AvaMed, a lobbying group that represents major manufacturers, here we go, big food, big drug, big money, big politics, big lobbying, you know, they rejected the findings of the new report saying, quote, we recommend entirely, the committee recommends entirely scraping this proven process with a vague new plan that contains no useful guidance. There is no proven process. Apparently, the way the present system works is that thousands of devices are routinely cleared for the market without any of the clinical testing for safety or effectiveness that's required, for example, prescription drugs. So it turns out the FDA was given this responsibility in 1976. But Congress specified, a lobby, that those already on the market continue to be sold without testing. At the same time, Congress created a so-called 510 process under which new devices could be cleared for market if they were substantially equivalent to existing products. So if some guy comes along and he invented a new hip transplant, he goes, oh, mine's just like Bill's, so it should be approved. And they went, oh, okay, and they approved it. So basically all these hip devices have not been tested by anybody. So as a result, thousands of medical devices have received FDA clearance based upon older devices, neither of which were subjected to any kinds of pre-market testing that would be required for other things. So they had a study of high-risk recalls from 2005 to 2009. And they found that more than two-thirds of medical devices recalled had potentially serious risks, and all of them went through this expedited approval process. More than 90,000 artificial hips were recalled last summer after studies showed that 1 in 8 recipients need to have them replaced. They're all manufactured by a subsidiary of Johnson & Johnson. So in 2009, the Institute of Medicine noted 4,000 medical devices were cleared under this expedited process, more than 90% of all devices subject to FDA clearance. That means 90% of everything from tongue depressors, adhesive strips, heart monitors, defibrillator, all these, none of them have ever been research tested or approved before they've been the problem.
I'm still stuck on 1 out of 8. 1 out of 8 recipient has a problem?
A serious one.
One out of 8 recipients need to have them replaced.
Right.
Oh, okay. I actually wanted to do this on a different program, but I have to ask the question. So I have one of these artificial hips, and I get a letter saying that it's subject to a recall. What does it really mean? Does it mean that I have to, the person that paid through the stinking nose in the first place, is going to pay through the nose again, you know, so that you can take the bad Toyota hip out and put a new Toyota hip in?
Yeah, that's, I'm not sure. Well, first of all, most people have to sue. So, yes, that's probably one of the biggest problems with this is that really the only remedy that I know of is to sue, and frequently if you do file a lawsuit, you're not going to get any help at all from the manufacturer in terms of paying for your hip. So, yes, that is a major problem. So people are burdened with this problem, and insurance companies, by the way, are upset about having to pay for it, too. So there's a certain element in the insurance companies that don't want to approve payment. And by the way, one of the common things that's going on that people complain to me about, and it happened to me once, is I got approval for a surgery from Blue Cross, and then Blue Cross turned around when it was time to pay for it, decided they didn't want to pay for it because they changed their mind and didn't think I really needed it. Which is always nice, right?
That's why I call them doctor insurance, because they're the ones making the final decision on what treatment you get. And isn't a treating person an MD? So I guess they should be called doctor insurance, even if they're a secretary in the room saying no.
So essentially we're at a position where I have my artificial hip. I get a letter that basically says, oh, we found a problem. You know, one in eight people.
Oops, you've got to start with oops. Oops, we found a problem. Go ahead, Simon.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one in eight people, you know, have a real big problem with this artificial hip. So we just want to let you know that, you're probably going to die. Is that what they're saying?
Well, no, you're not going to die from it, but if you've known anyone who's had a hip transplant, why would anybody volunteer for that level of pain? You know, this is about pain threshold. These people forget that people actually go through these surgeries, suffer a tremendous amount of pain, miss work, you know, do all these various things that it just seems like they don't care about.
Well, one of the things I really wanted to talk about was, especially since Kobe Bryant, the Laker guy, is over in Germany getting surgery, I wanted to take a moment and talk about, because this one really bugs me. It really bothers me that other options are available. And if you don't know there's other options available and take that option 1 through Z, then you think you're going to see a surgeon, and that surgeon only does hip replacement. And he only does X, and he's got somebody else standing there with a short skirt going, come on, and here's a new replacement. I think this replacement might be better, and it's cheaper. So now he's going into the next X. You don't know what's going on in that office. And your option is, I'm going to go get this replacement. When I was in Germany, I was there helping a friend, and I was strictly there as an advocate because I am not licensed in Austria or Germany.
Oh, stop it. Let's tell the beginning of the story. Our friend called me up one night and said, you know, I gotta go in tomorrow. I'm having my knee replacement done, whatever. And I said, you're crazy. What are you doing that for? They wanted to replace their left
double
knee.
Double amputee.
Well, they they wanted to replace her left knee. When they were done, they were going to replace her right knee. And she was going to have a double knee replacement. And I said to you, you're crazy. You have the ability to go to Europe. Go to Europe and have this surgery done by someone in Europe and do what the other people do. Use the stem cell type of treatment. Do not do this. And she thought about it, and she called her doctor and said no, which is so rare, because most people, once they're committed to doing this, just can't back out. Oh, no, I got this tomorrow. Like, you know, it's not moments like a wedding. You can't get people to back out of weddings. You can't get them back out of surgeries. So at the end of the day, she went over to Europe and Ashley went with her, and now you can tell your story.
So the first surgery, they went in and they cleaned out her knee. Then they took the area that was damaged, the cells from that area. They grew in the lab. She came back, allowed that portion of the knee to heal for 6 weeks while the stem cells grew in the lab. Then she received a phone call to say, okay, they're ready, and back on a plane, back to Austria. And the surgeon, who is a specialist in this area in Graz, Austria, he then took the knee area, reinserted the stem cells. She had to have a little metal support on the right side of her knee that after 18 months could be removed if she chose to. She went through the surgery, and in 18 months, the area regrew. What was going to have to be a complete device was what they were going to put in there. An amputation of that area and a new device put in its place. Now, you had the barbaric over here, and she was going to have double. Many people end up with a shorter leg because they can't help it. It just happens. They end up with a limp. They end up with pain. The pain doesn't go away. You now have a new device in. So instead of that, she ended up having extensive therapy here for 18 months of her life. She's now walking around with her own knee, all her own equipment, and everything's completely rehealed. So there are other options out there rather than saying, I want a new device. My surgeon said. Look at all of it. There's more than just one doctor at that point.
Well, yeah. You know, people can't afford it. Not everybody can afford to go to Europe. But there's other doctors like that
in this country.
But that's not the point. The point to this is that the American medicine is so far behind European medicine that why do Americans have to go abroad to have this surgery they could easily have at home if the American doctors cared enough to learn something from foreign doctors? But instead, all I ever hear is that, oh, those European doctors don't know what they're doing, they're this or that. Well, my experiences are they not only know more than American doctors, they have a more of an open mind, and they're just years ahead of the U.S. doctors in terms of treatments and other things. So I'm not here advocating everybody go abroad. I'm advocating that American medicine catch up with European medicine instead of claiming we're the only ones who know anything, which is, of course, the comment everybody in Europe makes to me, that the American government and America is becoming so arrogant they think they're the only ones who can solve a problem or they're the only ones who can invent a cure, when if you take a look at most of the cures in this world, they've been written and done by people like Madame Curie. We're certainly not living in the old West. So I think that's one of the things we need to look at.
I do, too.
Well,
I have to do.
Obviously, you know, this is changing the subject slightly, but I think is still very pertinent. How come a number of U.S.-based people get their drugs from, let's say, Canada?
Well,
it's cheaper.
And the quality of the drugs are better.
Yet, Simon, I think the average is that one-fifth of the drugs that are coming into this country are coming from China and coming from India. So you've got your generic drugs, which are all coming from China and India. So essentially, we are actually buying foreign made materials anyway.
Well, let's
so,
hit that. Wait a minute, honey. Let's hit that one right on the button. When the issue of buying drugs from Canada comes up, what do we hear the industry say? You can't buy drugs from Canada. They're not very good. How can you trust drugs from Canada? Well, I'd rather trust something from Canada than I'd rather try and trust something from China.
Do you know that some of the pharmaceutical companies or the pharmaceutical places that they're making, not the pharmacies itself, but the pharmaceutical companies making those products, many of them are not licensed? So you have unlicensed pharmaceutical production companies making generic drugs in China coming into this country. I don't know about you, Sam, but I do have a problem with that.
Oh, I have an absolutely huge problem with that. If a doctor tells me I need to take, you know, this pill, Well, I actually have a problem with that as well. But, you know, I go to the pharmacy and I expect it to be absolutely A1 top-notch quality. I don't expect it to be some Chinese knockoff.
Sold at American prices.
Right.
Right.
You know,
it gets back to that heparin where they were talking about the heparin problem that was made in 2008 made in China, where it was $9 to produce the product and it was being sold here as $900 for the heparin.
Yeah.
And a coagulant.
So
made
so,
from pig intestines.
Well, yeah, and what bothers me most about it is that they're basically charging exorbitant prices, and then they complain that any effort to rein in this as the big dollars in lobbying goes on. And why do you think they have so much lobbying? Because they make so much money they can afford to. That's
sure.
The bottom line. If they weren't making all this money, they couldn't afford to do all this lobbying that they're doing. And it just goes right across the board. I mean, basically, when you look at these stories and you look at the fact and you stop and go, you mean a knee, an artificial knee has never been tested? That nobody really has looked at this product or done anything with it? And we're going to come up with this because one of our topics we've been raising has been ghostwriting. And this is where ghostwriting comes into me, for me, is that when you ghostwrite, let me give an example. Take the artificial hip. I'm sure if we go back, we're going to find an article, a series of articles by doctors and academics that are going to say, oh, these are just the greatest things. They're going to solve every problem. This is the one you should buy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And at the end of the day, they are promoting, by writing these articles, these products, and creating a marketplace. Well, we now know that most of these articles are ghostwritten. So does that mean that anyone who, and that includes doctors who prescribed and are using these, does that mean that they're relying on these medical articles that aren't true? So is it a reality that basically doctors are picking these products based upon untruthful statements by the manufacturer? Well, if that's true, that's a level of fraud, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. From what I've been able to glean about the subject, a ghostwriter has had nothing whatsoever to do with the research, and basically just cherry picks the good bits and artfully avoids the bad bits of the results. So a well-meaning doctor, and I believe that the vast majority of our doctors are well-meaning.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, they do want to do the best they possibly can for their patient. But
within the limitations of what they're given in this country.
Right. You know, new drugs, new procedures happen all the time. They base their decisions on articles written by or published in well-respected peer-reviewed journals. And now we're finding that those articles are a load of bullshit. There's something wrong here.
Even the drug book that is sent out to nurses is put out by the drug industry. So everything that goes out is actually put out by the drug industry. And so all that material that you get, you don't ever think about the fact that you've got somebody who is not a scientist writing the material and putting the material together. I guarantee you one thing. Nowhere in any article, because when they show an artificial knee, and this is the thing, everybody wants to get one of these, and they show this beautiful picture, oh, this is going to relieve all your arthritis. Forget about the science and everything else. This is going to do it. And they show this device. They do not say anywhere on that particular article, one out of eight of the hip replacement, one out of eight of you are going to have this replaced again because this device is going to malfunction. I guarantee you that's not said anywhere.
No. And that's one of the things that bothers. There's no warnings. There's no disclaimer. There's no, let's put it this way. There's no honesty and ethics in corporate business. And it's hard for any American who listens to this to find an American corporation they believe is honest and ethical in how they deal with the general public. Most Americans just hold these corporations in the same low regard that we are right now. I mean, I'm not interested in doing business with a company that just thinks everything's fine as long as they lie to me.
What bothered me in this article the most was the fact that the person, say this happened to me or to my husband, which I already did with Vioxx. Now, you're going to go into court, which we did not do. But where you're going to get into court, and the court documents and the people defending the drug company and the doctor who authored this, who actually is not the author, it's the signature only, or whoever it was that signed that particular thing, you don't see the ghostwriter. You don't see the advertiser. What you see is that particular article, that particular doctor who signed that material that is ghostwritten, going into court saying, you know, this actually worked. This is what I had. I can defend it completely. Now, isn't that what's happening, Manny? I mean, that's what was bothersome to me is the fact that these people will go into court, put their hand on a Bible, raise that hand and say, I swear God, this is the truth, and the truth is not this. Uh-huh. Now, that poor person doesn't know it, and the jury doesn't know it. And the jury's never once said, unless it's a really good defender of that person who's been injured, they're never going to hear the fact of who was the author of the actual writer of that material, who made up that material. And that's what's bothersome to me.
Well, you know, Simon, let me offer a lawyer's thought. People are suing personal injury, medical malpractice, and sue over these devices and everything. You know, when you get these lawsuits, immediately drug companies hire experts, and these experts are always going to argue about why a drug or a device is safe. And how do they establish whether it's safe? By using some scientific journal for what are called the Daubert purposes, which is an evidence thing, okay? Basically, these articles are originally written for marketing purposes to sell drugs, but in reality, they become used more in court to so what happens is, basically, a doctor stands up and they say, what are your qualifications? He goes, well, I wrote a piece on hip replacements in the market. I studied hip replacements for this thing. I did this or that. I wrote this paper. It's published in the Harvard, in the New England Journal of Medicine and the AMA or, you know, all the rest of these things. And he puffs up his chest like I'm the great author and authority. Well, the reality is he may not have written any of those articles. It may have been written by a ghostwriter like Dreamwrite, which we talk about in our articles. It gets between $10,000 and $25,000 to write these articles. And, Simon, if I may amplify on something you said, it isn't that they're cherry-picking. Those are what Ashley describes as the, what is it like, their head notes for lawyers.
Abstracts. They take the abstracts.
Their head notes for lawyers, abstracts for doctors. So what happens is, someone's paid $25,000 to write this article. They get an academic who's famous to put his name on it, pay him a bunch of money. And then another writer comes along, gets $10,000 to reduce this to a tight little two-paragraph summary to send to doctors, is what we call head notes for lawyers and abstracts. So the doctor reads the abstract and goes, wow, that sounds like a great drug or a great device. I got to use it. But doctors don't take time to read the 25-page report, and had they read the entire report, they may find it says something completely different. But in most cases, that report has been written by someone else, too. So basically, the company that makes the device or drug controls the content by hiring their writers.
Then first, they hire the scientists and control the scientists.
No, that's not true, Ashley.
Sorry.
Sometimes, in most cases, from what I've written from the Dreamwrite and other cases, they have a purpose of what they want. Look at Vioxx. They knew what they wanted. They went to Scott Rubin. They told him what they wanted. He went out and started doing tests at their behest. They knew what the result they wanted because they wanted this blockbuster drug approved. And Scott Rubin went out and said, okay.
Dr. Scott Rubin, MD.
MD from Harvard.
Right.
Teaching in Boston. Went out and created the basic test and the answers that they wanted for their purposes. But the head notes were written by somebody else, and the finished article was written by someone else. But in his case, he actually did fraudulent work by misrepresenting the data and all the rest. But in most cases,
there were no patients.
There's no data other than what the company provides. And we look at genetically modified foods. We know our complaint is that Monsanto knows the truth, but they won't release their testing. And the reason is because in most instances, they could have a ghostwriter do the articles. They could have a doctor sign for money. They can have an abstract written by somebody for more money. But because of the nature of this product, everybody, you, me, and everyone else in this business would go read the entire test. So therefore, the ghostwriter would not be worth anything, and the abstracts wouldn't be worth anything, because we all have an agenda to read the truth. But in most cases, doctors don't have that agenda. They go, gee, why would Merck, Pfizer, or Bayer, or one of these people lie to me? Well, the answer is a voice should be screaming from the back of the room, money, of course, but doctors don't think in those terms.
Well, they don't have time. Their schedules are, like, ridiculous with the type of poor payment from insurance companies, et cetera. So doctor insurance is back in the face again. And I think it's just it's a big snowball, and everything else follows.
But, Ashley, you've been with me in doctor's offices, medical clients
right.
of mine, when doctors have said to me, truthfully, with the door closed, that they're suspicious of a lot of these drug tests. And one of my favorite quotes is I said to a doctor client of mine, well, how do you think this came out? And he looked at me and said, it wasn't as successful as the drug company hoped it would be. And it was a cynical remark about they've spent all this money to create all these tests and do everything else, and the doctors weren't believing them. So there are some doctors who are starting to take a harder look at it, but they're swimming upstream, and it's not even upstream. It's straight up the Niagara Falls and the flow of a huge weight of money pouring down those falls that buries anyone who criticizes them. And, Simon, you've had your experiences with doctors with this and drugs.
Yeah. But, I mean, what really, really bothers me are some of the, quote, independent tests. You said something very telling. They know the result they want to get. My background is not medical. My background is computer geeking. And occasionally I've, you know, been asked to look at, you know, some particular situation. And, you tailor the test to meet the result. And I, you know, it's one thing for me to do that, to pull the wool over, you know, half a dozen people's eyes in a small company. It's an entirely different thing to pull the wool over people's eyes countrywide. I mean, it should not be allowed. And this gets me on to why are these independent tests not independent? 30 years ago, and I can't remember the exact statistic, National Institute of Health sponsored something like 90% of all of this work. Today it's under 10%. So you've got the foxes guarding the hen house to begin with. I mean, this is wrong.
It is wrong because it's the devaluation of life. To me, it's about, that's what it comes down to me, to not care about a life, a person that you may harm in any way at all. And people who are not in medicine should not be making these decisions, from doctor insurance secretary to these drug companies. They should not be allowed to have the amount of control that they have. But it goes back to the Rockefellers. You know, the guy, you know, old Bill Rockefeller, that story we're talking about with the drug story where, you know, he ran around with his bottle of oil out of his standard oil, or what, not standard, it's whatever the oil made for a cancer drug. And it is standard oil, and it is just oil. Oil in a bottle, here you go, it's just, this is for cancer, poisoning people everywhere he went. And, you know, this guy and his whole companies and all their money are influencing the drug companies, are influencing the universities, that are influencing how people are treated.
We're going to get back to this on Saturday's show because we're going to be talking about salmon and transgenic fish again. But it's true even then, because in that food system, they basically do not release the information in testing. And lately there's been a lot of articles and memos and things released within the department we're going to discuss on.
Emails, stolen emails.
They are not stolen emails. They're whistleblower emails from people within the department who are thoroughly disgusted with where the agency is going, and they're starting to release information to the general public that shows that they're not being truthful. So when it's down to the point where employees in the federal government have to blow the whistle because they feel that everybody in the department is lying, is a really negative statement on where we are in this country. So
I don't know if this affects federal employees, but I know that a number of states are actually looking at anti-whistleblower laws. So, it's going to make it an even more uphill battle for them.
Well, those attempts to me are somewhat like the attempts to control voting rights right now. What you have is a problem where the federal government has basically preempted the field. So if you want to have a state whistleblower act, then it can only relate to something that's in state and is not part of interstate commerce. So the federal government has basically occupied this field, and they just can't get up and pass local state laws because they disagree with the federal government. We saw that recently with a bunch of laws were stricken down because they were preempted by the federal government. So that will be harder to do than the industry would like. And, yes, they're going to press it every single way they can because guess what? That's how they quell free speech. And when I listen to a variety of different people, particularly in the Republican government, talk about, you know, freedoms and, you know, all the rest of it. Well, the fact is the Republican government takes away more freedoms than any of the other forms of government in the United States. And if you take a look at it, every Nixon, Bush, all the rest of them reduced American freedoms. And at the same time, they also, in this case, raised our budget by, what was it, $7 or $8 trillion. And I don't see anybody slamming Bush for how he destroyed this country in the last couple of years and left the present government holding the bag. But it's what happens.
And all of this stuff that happened with the drugs I see as new. Isn't this new from since Bush was around with the deregulation of everything?
Well,
I never understood regulation until this has occurred. And the fact that this deregulation to me means that all these corporations get to do whatever they want, even though you go, well, FDA's in there looking at it, but, you know, they're really not.
No, they're not.
Not when you have 2,000 drug recalls in a year and 2 months or a year and 4 months.
Well, I don't think it's really deregulation so much as regulation by the industry itself. We're big boys. We know what we're doing. Trust us.
While they're,
you know,
handing them money.
Right. You know, you don't want to be spending a lot of money doing this investigation. You know, we'll do it for you because we're good corporate citizens and we really support, you know, the cause. I mean, it's bullshit. I mean, the FDA is bullshit. They are accepting industry, quote, independent studies and approving it. I'm sure that the rank and file at the FDA are horrified.
I'm sure the top levels and the scientists in the FDA have to be horrified with some of the things that are going on because these are really, you know, high IQ, well-educated individuals who they have to know. They just have to.
Well,
right.
the real problem is
who runs the FDA? It's political appointees. I mean, you know, the rank and file have virtually no say in this.
That's right. And that's the problem. And you know, what bothers me even more about it is the fact that there's no interest in changing it. You notice what we discussed a little earlier, the issues involving trying to get these devices into a better system to have them approved, and immediately industry objects, and the FDA goes, oh, well, there's an objection from the industry. We can't really do anything. Well, wait a minute. I mean, the general public objects, and they just basically ignore us. But if the industry objects, suddenly they're, oh, my goodness, we can't do anything. And that really bothers me.
And that 1 in 8 is just a hip replacement. We're not talking about all the other devices, so I can't imagine the millions of people who have been permanently damaged or injured by this poor equipment.
Right. And now, you know, the hip replacement was an absolutely new thing to me. I had not really looked at it before today's program. And I was completely clueless, unaware that there was no testing. I mean, does this mean that any old person can come up with a new medical device and basically it gets an automatic stamp of approval?
No, not anybody, but if you're a big-name manufacturer with a lot of political juice, yes. I mean, it's a double standard. The rest of us aren't able to get away with what they're doing. I certainly couldn't get away with that, and neither could you. In fact, that's how they control their opposition, is because they have the ability to spend more money than you do on political contributions. So guess what? They get a better treatment by the government. And that's the other problem, is how do you get rid of your competition? Well, have the government on your side and have them shut down your competition.
So, Manny, one of the questions I have, too, is there is a thing called the RICO Influenced Act or the Corrupt Organizations Act. I mean, doesn't any of this come in at all anywhere in this for fraud?
I would love to see a RICO charge against one of these companies.
It seems to me there should be something that goes on. I mean, aren't there court cases and things that occurred that might influence some of the...
Well, yes, we were heading for that anyway. But, you know, basically, RICO is an interesting thing, okay? RICO is the Racketeer Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act, and it usually applies to mobsters. And basically what happens is, anything that is an act done within, I think it's 10 years, and done by two or more people, and or sent twice to interstate commerce, a variety of other different factors become RICO. Well, at some point, RICO was a very popular way to sue, but the Republican Supreme Court has limited its applications to more crime entities, which is really a sad thing. But what's happened, and let me give you an example, okay? And we're going to look back a little history, and I hate to bore people with too much law, but there's a case called Hazel Atlas Glass versus Hartford Empire Company, another glass company that went on from 1926 until 1944. So what happened is, in 1926, Hartford tried to patent a method of molding glass. So they got a lot of skepticism from the patent office, so Hartford employees wrote an article lauding their method as an important advance, and then found an author for it, a guy named William Clark, who was the president of the Flint Glassworkers Union, to publish the article under his name. And then they cited the article they wrote for themselves to the patent office, and a little pressure, they got the patent granted. Well, 2 years later, Hartford sued Hazel, the competing glass manufacturer, for infringing on the patent, and they lost the trial. On appeal, Hartford leaned heavily on the spurious articles they wrote themselves. And Hazel company doubted his legitimacy, and they interviewed Clark, but he refused to acknowledge the truth. They were suspicious, and they knew that this was bought and paid for, but they couldn't prove it. So the Court of Appeals ruled for Hartford, the company wrote the fraudulent article, quoting from the article as evidence of the patent's novelty and utility. Well, that's the point I'm making. They create these articles, they lie about them, and then they use to market and sell the products, and when they get sued, they use the same lying article to basically defend themselves. Well, 9 years later, when they were sued under antitrust action, their files came out under a federal subpoena, and they found out that this was a lie and that the whole thing was a fraud. So it went back before the court, and in 1944, the Supreme Court vacated prior judgment, sanctioned Hartford's use of the article as fraud on the court.
From 1926 to 1944.
When it took
basically
18 years. And then the court nullified the patent, so he struck the patent, and the lawyers were disbarred from the practice in front of the patent office. They should have been disbarred completely. And the court, in explaining why they merited this action, offered several observations that apply with basically the same force to what we're talking about today. They said that the use of these spurious, which means spacious or, you know, dishonest, lying, manipulative claims of the author to legitimate the patent application and the product itself, quote, is a wrong against the institution set up to protect and safeguard the public. Well, that's where we are today. Every one of these articles, same thing. So if you carry that through today, I don't see how that's any, what they're doing today, it should be treated the same way. And what was funny is that Hartford argued it was impossible to prove the article was responsible for the legal victory. So they had to admit it was a lie, then they claimed, but that's not why we won. Well, the court rejected that argument with a great quote. Hartford's officials and lawyers thought the article material. They went to considerable trouble and expense to get it published. They urged the article upon the circuit court and prevailed. There is no position now to dispute its effectiveness. In other words, they were talking out of both sides of their mouth. Oh, it's great. No, it didn't count now. No harm, no foul, and steal one from Chick Hearn. So basically, that's where we are today. These people lie. They get things approved. People get hurt. Now, if Toyota had a car that caused the damage of 1 out of 8 people, had to have hip surgery because of their car, can you imagine the concern that would cause? Look what happened to motor sticking accelerator.
Oh, and the people go through with that surgery. Anybody who's known anybody, it is so painful. And the thought of possible infections and the infections that go with it, and, oh, my gosh, to have to do it twice? Forget it.
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of anything worse. Anyone who's had any kind of surgery, if you some, would you want to go through that again? No. In fact, I tried to talk somebody out of a knee replacement a month and a half ago. So, well, the doctor says I have to have it. I have
arthritis. It's the only answer. Wrong.
Oh, wrong. So she had the surgery, and guess what? The first thing she said to me after a month of rehab is, I would never do this surgery again. And I said, well, you had a hip replacement a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. I said, just understand that you have a 1 in 8 chance of having that surgery replaced. And she was like, oh, my God, I couldn't go through this before. So forget about the problem with statistics is they're not human beings. It's the human beings. 1 out of every hip replacements, I don't know the number, but it's 50, 100,000 a year or more are having second surgeries. That's almost like, you know, Torquemada medicine. I mean, it's basically torture. You know, do you feel...
I absolutely agree.
Simon, can you imagine a doctor telling you, oh, remember that painful hip surgery I had 2 years ago? It took you 2 months to recover from that was so painful. We're going to do it again. What would you
say? I'd be leaping up and down in his office going, oh, joy, oh, joy.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, I'd be saying, you know, I'm leaving now.
Oh, I can't wait to get the surgery. Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy.
And Simon, I can tell you as a lawyer, not one doctor said to their patient, you know, this is being done because no one ever tested the hip implant that I put in, and we really had no testing of it, and you're really being experimented on, and, gee, I couldn't help it. Because that person would immediately go find a lawyer and sue somebody. So the doctor's not going to mention, because guess what? Even though he didn't know, he put the hip replacement in, and he is subject to liability too. So basically, we now know that a significant number, if not most, of these studies are industry-sponsored clinical trials. And as a result, you know, at the end of the day, you're getting something that's done dishonestly. So anyone who wants to read a full recent article that came out, it's called Legal Remedies for Medical Ghostwriters, Writing, Imposing Fraud Liability on Guest Authors of Ghostwritten Articles. So it's not just us. This appeared in PLOS, which is the public science magazine, and this is what should appear on every test that does not appear in the ones done by the government. Let me read this quote, Ashley. Funding. The research is supported by a grant from the Social Services and Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council on the promotion of integrity in biomedical research. Listen to this. The funders had no role in study design, data collection, and analysis, decision to publish, or preparation of manuscript. In other words, they gave him the money and did not get involved and offered no opinion. Now, the next thing they list are competing interests. The authors have declared no competing interests exist. In other words, they have not taken money to write the article. They're not employed by any of the manufacturers and they have no interest. That one, though, we've seen lots of lies to. We have this doctor at Emory University, the one at Stanford. We have Biederman at Harvard, who have all lied on those statements when they were taking as much as $1 million under the table from the manufacturers to recommend, among other things, some drugs for children that now claim that they were giving these antipsychotic drugs.
Oh, when they got to, I think it was 3 years old, they wanted to start them on or something.
Well,
it was like this ridiculous age that was just mind-boggling.
And doctors are still doing it, despite the fact that New York Times and others have written experts saying that the tests don't support any of this. So one doctor, I can't remember his name, I wish I did, he's in our book at Emory, basically got $1 million. And then when he was caught by Senator Grassley from Nebraska, because he didn't, you have to declare any gift above $10,000, he promised Emory that he would comply. Well, the next year, he got about $250,000, and he reported $9,999. So 1 year later, he was doing the same willful fraud and lying.
And nothing happened to him.
No
problem. Nothing happens to these people, right?
Can you imagine, as a lawyer, me taking $10,000 under the table to do something dishonest, and I don't get disbarred?
So Manny, when these doctors who sign this authorship that end up not actually doing the study themselves, and they are done with the guest writer, and the guest writer actually does it, the doctor or whoever comes in and makes the final signature, who has the authority, is this person liable? Who's liable in this for injury that occurs to a person as a result of the big fat lie?
Well, that's going to be interesting, because it's only been caught in recent times, so there are no cases that really carefully delineate this, but I can tell you the likelihood is that that liability is going to be passed on to everybody in what we call the chain, the everybody who touched this in some manner. And it's just a question of time before a very good lawyer pins the tail on the donkey, so to speak, because you cannot sit here in life and put things out under your name that are dishonest and untrue and not expect consequences in our country.
But when they go to trial, does anybody ever see the actual original scientific data to make that statement that they're looking at?
Yes, very good lawyers do. I have never had a witness on the witness stand that involved this type of stuff where I didn't read the articles myself to determine what they really say. In fact,
so you went back into the actual original scientific data.
Right.
Do you think that company will allow you to have that data?
Well, no. I go through. First of all, I read the actual study, and then I look for people who either agree or disagree with its contents, because there are a great many experts out there who will tell you that, you know, this is absolute nonsense. This is written by the industry for the sole purpose of getting approval. And there are a lot of experts and honest people out there who will just tell you the truth.
So there are a lot of medical doctors who actually look at this material and say, this is bogus. No,
I'm saying medical experts, people who are experts and witnesses who spend their entire time looking at this kind of conduct and either appearing on behalf of lawyers in lawsuits or for whatever reasons that, you know, do it for their interest. But my point about it is that you have to check everything like that because you cannot believe what the other person puts out in the practice of law because, frankly, they will lie and they will do it often. And if anything, they're rewarded for lying. That's the sad part of all this, is there's actually rewards for these companies. They're paid handsomely to lie and they get away with it.
What is really bothering me in this discussion is that I see winners and I only see one loser. And the loser is the poor person with that hip replacement or whatever it might be.
And who can't afford to even sue somebody to get compensated.
And then we hear the corporate mantra, there are too many tort lawyers out there, and the reason our product costs so much is we're being sued by all these lawyers, and the lawyers the reason that your costs are going up. That's not true. First of all, every study shows they're making stuff in China and selling it at a greater profit. So I don't see anybody's costs going up. I just see that as a big lie. Second of all, don't make a substandard product and then try and tell me, oh, it's okay because, you know, lawyers are the real problem. The fact is they can't hide the fact they're making garbage. So why shouldn't we be able to sue a company who recklessly makes garbage, doesn't test it, you know, hurts individuals, causes them to have double surgeries. I'm sure that person who's had the double surgery doesn't think it's okay. And then blame it on lawyers? Please, give me a break.
Well, I guess there's a problem right now with knee devices, too. I just saw something that I didn't get a chance to read the article, so I don't want to get into it today, but there is also one with knees that's going on right now.
Well, that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, I know, but you're talking about hips, and I'm also putting it out there for
oh,
people with the
oh,
knees.
Oh, yeah, knees are also
right.
High on this list, too.
So recalls.
So in general, our entire system for developing these kind of medical devices is so screwed up that almost every one of them in some form or another needs to have some type of correction or fixing. Whoa, oh, gee, that's wonderful.
And the deal is don't believe the ads. Those ads are not where you go to find out your information. And one of the things that I was going over this morning was the bad ad program, which was written up in August of 2010. This was done by the FDA Division of Drug Marketing, Advertising, and Communications. They did intensive educational outreach effort. Now, this program, at the end of it, said, when sponsoring drug companies are found using misleading materials, the FDA issues warning letters stating that the ads must be revised. This was how they were going to fix the problem. In effect, that's all they're going to do. They cite them, and they are going to give them a warning letter. So I guess that's going to take care of everything. Right, Simon? And our tax dollars paid for this division of drug marketing, advertising, communications.
Yeah. Oh, way to go.
Spend all this money and put all these heads together, and this is what you're going to come up with. You have to be able to providers, the bad ad program will help healthcare providers recognize misleading prescription drug promotion, provide them with an easy way to report this activity to the agency.
Oh, yeah.
That's going to fix it.
I mean, you know, I can almost see the letter in front of me. You know, dear sir, we think it's a bit misleading that your new drug, XYZ, is, you know, claiming that people can live to be 400 years old. We suspect that it's just an error on your behalf. Can you please amend the advert?
Yeah.
I mean, how is that going to solve anything? How is that going to solve anything? Oh, so this particular went on to say that due to the volume of the submissions, these warning letters aren't sent until months after the misleading ad is released. And although these efforts are effective, the agency also has a limited ability to monitor promotional activities that may be going on behind doors. Boy, I like the bad ad program. This really takes care of things, doesn't it?
Well, so it's going to make me sleep safer at night.
And you know what? We're going to have our Social Security or Medicare cuts so that we can fund more programs like this, because I like this one.
Yeah, it's just really a wonderful, wonderful way to run our country, isn't it? It just
so what's the fix on it? I mean, this is kind of depressing. Is there no fix?
Well, to do what we're doing, just keep, you know, basically standing up and complaining. And again, you know, our point is join the food revolution. It's simple. Just read the labels, reject foods with addictive chemical ingredients. Basically reject products that aren't tested. Ask your doctor, has this been tested? Have you read the test? What's wrong with asking your doctor that question?
Ask him the name of the device.
Yeah.
Look that device up on the internet. See how many recalls. Put lawsuit after that device and see how many lawsuits are going on that.
Yeah.
And recall. Put recall after it, too.
I mean, you wouldn't. Most people basically look at cars. They read car books. They test them. They drive everything else. They do everything before they decide which car to buy. But when it comes to knee replacements or hip replacements, they just go in. The doctor says, "Oh, you know what you need is a 1990 Datsun. It was designed in 1990. Never tested. We're just going to throw it in your knee." Because that's essentially the same thing as the suggesting you use a knee replacement that's maybe 20 years old, and maybe the doctor doesn't know, but he should know that they've already been, you know, 1 out of 8 people replacements. So why are doctors putting in these devices and recommending it to people when they know there's a 1 in 8 chance that it's going to be replaced? So you need to
simple answer to that one. Money. Insurance companies. I'm sure that if you recommend to a patient, "Oh, there's this new device. You know, this is what you need." The insurance company is going to go, "No, we don't have a code for that."
Well,
unfortunately, that's true.
But in the case of most knee devices, they are covered. Generally, doctors make decisions based upon which conference they go to. Maybe ABC... company that makes their knee device sent him to Hawaii to a clinic to look and understand how they did it and paid for his entire trip there. So he feels some loyalty to that company. Or maybe he's just convinced after listening to this whole marketing spiel in Hawaii that they know exactly what they're doing and it's the right product. So
And he probably had his best 18 holes of golf ever.
Well, if you've played in Hawaii, that's a hard place to have your best 18 holes of golf. But, yeah, basically, these guys go to a minimum amount of conferences to do a maximum amount of rest and relaxation. And that's the purpose of the trip. It's an R&R trip.
So the purpose is not to wait till you don't allow yourself to get to the position where you have no choice. The choice begins every time you go to the market. The choice begins every time you open your mouth and put that fork in your mouth. That choice begins every single thing you put a chemical in your mouth, and that chemical breakdown, or whether it's a piece of cheese, or know what you're eating and putting in your body, and keep it organic.
And I'm going to end the show with this thought. When I was diagnosed with cancer, Ashley urged me to think about it, not rush into the surgery. I said, "Well, you know, it's malignant. I got to do this now, blah, blah, blah." And there's nothing I regret more than doing that surgery prematurely. If had I backed off and I would have thought about it for a few days, probably seen another doctor, I would not have had the surgery that I did.
You may have had surgery, but not extensive
I did that particular.
Oh, yeah.
And especially since he went far beyond what we had discussed. So anyway, to make a long story short, it's been my experience, the hard way, that one needs to sit back and look at this more circumspectly. Don't jump into anything. You don't jump into anything and any other thing in life. Why is it we jump into medical procedures?
Fear.
So on that note, ladies and gentlemen, you can think about all this. Tune in on Saturday. We have scores of food recalls we didn't get to today.
Tons of them. You got to hear the recalls. You've got to.
They're really frightening when you take a look at what's going on. So anyway,
I'm watching one on the TV as we speak.
Is that about the guy who died of turkey, eating turkey in California? Because that's one on our list.
Oh, I think that's going to get a big mention on Saturday.
Oh, yes. We're definitely going to do a whole thing on that and the impact on the body. And oh, yeah. That's a good subject for Saturday. Can we do that one Saturday, Simon?
Oh, we're going to do it.
Absolutely. We're just about out of time. Manny, do you have any parting thoughts for us?
Yeah, vote with your checkbook. If you don't sign the check, things change in life, and that's the best way to solve all your problems and almost everything you do. Just don't write a check and don't agree to do it, because as long as you hold back that check, people will listen to you. And the minute you write that check, suddenly you don't have a voice in this country anymore. And that's my thought, and have a great day.
How about you, Ashley? Any parting thoughts for us?
Prevention, prevention, prevention. And then if you're sick, you can reverse what's there. You can. Your body is meant to heal itself. It's a slow process when you get too far down the line, but your body can heal itself with the right organic foods, the right supplements. Read our books. Please, read our books.
And my final thoughts, I want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today. And Manny, Ashley, and I will be back on Saturday, 1 p.m. Eastern. At least I think that's the time.
You're right.
Oh, these time zones. Join us on Saturday for Surviving the 21st Century. And we have a couple of really, really important subjects to talk about. Number one is this huge turkey, or ground turkey recall from the Cargill company. This is far bigger than people understand. And we also are going to be exploring the very strange world of Aqua Bounty and their Franken salmon. Yummy stuff. Okay, till Saturday, this is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a happy and safe day. We will talk again soon. Goodbye.